This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. So there's this story about Whitey Bulger, one of many. This one starts back in 1984, when Bulger and Stephen the Rifleman Flemmy wanted to buy a liquor store in South Boston. And I say buy in quotes.
Stippo's Liquor Mart on Old Colony Avenue was owned by Stephen Rakes. Bulger and Flemmy showed up at Rakes' house, put a big bag of cash on the table, $67,000. But Rakes says his store's not for sale.
So Flemmy picks up Rakes' little girl and puts her in his lap. He says he lays his gun down on the table, and the little girl, she's a curious toddler, so she reaches for it and starts gumming the butt of the gun.
Then Bulger allegedly turns to Rakes and says, "It would be a real shame not to see your children grow up."
This is the guy. After 16 years on the run, this is the guy whom the FBI arrested last night in Santa Monica, California.
At approximately 5:45 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, using a ruse, agents and other task force members lured Mr. Bulger out of his apartment. Agents determined that the individual was, in fact, Mr. Bulger. He was placed under arrest without incident. Agents then went back into the apartment and arrested Miss Grieg without incident.
That was FBI Special Agent Richard Delores speaking this morning in Boston. The arrest of Whitey Bulger and his girlfriend Catherine Grieg ends one of the longest criminal manhunts in recent years. It also represents a major victory for the FBI, whose reputation had been badly damaged by its close association with Bulger and by its long and frustrating search for him. Here again is Special Agent Richard Delores.
Although there are those who have doubted our resolve at times over the years, it has never wavered. We followed every lead, we explored every possibility, and when those leads ran out, we did not sit back and wait for the phone to ring. The result is we have captured one of the FBI's 10 most wanted fugitives, a man notorious in Boston and around the world for very serious crimes he is alleged to have committed.
Those crimes include 19 alleged murders, racketeering, drug dealing, and extortion, much of which was done while he was working with the FBI as an informant. The story of how such a nasty man, a known criminal, became an FBI pal is a complicated one. So here's a little bit of background.
In the 1970s and 80s, the FBI recruited key underworld figures to help the Bureau crack the Italian mafia. In Boston, that led to a 1975 deal between a homegrown FBI agent, John Connolly, and James Whitey Bulger, both of them from Southie.
In fact, Connolly was a childhood friend of Whitey's younger brother, William Bulger. Connolly even worked on Billy Bulger's successful campaign for state rep in 1960.
And for the next 20 years, Connolly protected Bulger and his loan sharking and drug-running operation. And in 1996, when Bulger was about to be arrested, Connolly tipped him off. Connolly was convicted of racketeering and helping Bulger to escape. He was sent to jail, where he remains today.
Whitey Bulger remained on the lam until last night. The most wanted man on the FBI's most wanted man list is in federal custody. So what does this mean for Boston? What's your reaction? What are your South Boston stories of Whitey Bulger? And what do you think the Bulger FBI informant story tell us about crime and justice in Boston? What questions do you have about the case? Give us a call throughout the hour at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK.
And joining us now in the studio is WBUR's David Boeri, who's been following this story for years. And David, good to have you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Anthony.
What do we know about how long Whitey Bulger and his partner, Catherine Craig, was living out there in Santa Monica?
Well, it's stunning. The Associated Press is now reporting that neighbors say he's been there for 15 years. Absolutely stunning, because it wipes right off the board what the FBI had insisted was the reality. They had said the last known sighting was Bulger in 2002 in London. That changed the nature of the search for Bulger. Now, possibly he was traveling back and forth. It seems unlikely in a post-9/11 world that he was doing that. It looks like the reality was he was sitting under our noses for all this time. In Southern California, a place where there were a number of reported sightings over the years, America's Most Wanted took a number of sightings, as recent as last year, a number of significant sightings. I ran out there in a couple of cases, checking out Santa Monica, also Venice Beach, Mexico. It's not a place that is a surprise to anybody.
David, I heard you a little earlier today at the press conference that the FBI and the U.S. attorney held ask a question along these lines that, you know, had this, the FBI said that they started surveilling this site in Santa Monica on Tuesday of this week. And you asked, you know, had they been looking at it beforehand? Now that we're hearing that he'd been living there for maybe 15 years, what's your thoughts on the fact that they couldn't answer that question?
I mean, it's an uncomfortable situation for the Bureau. And it all goes back to the fact that they were corrupted by Bulger. And their search for Bulger in the early years was indifferent, incompetent, and some people said designed to protect Bulger. There was a great deal of cynicism. They have taken a lot of hits. That hold, it's another generation that's in charge now. But that investigation has not been particularly effective. And all along, there has been this debate. The state police wanted the U.S. Marshals to get involved in this. The Bureau insisted the Marshals not get in. There are a lot of people, quite frankly, that thought the Marshals are the real experts at finding people. As it turns out, the Marshals got involved just 7 months ago, and the guy that cracked this case was a U.S. Marshal who was put on the FBI task force. He was the one that they took 250 phone calls, I'm told, in response to that TV spot. It was call number 249. This guy said, this one goes to the top of the list. Get on this one. And that's the one that brought him to Santa Monica and to Whitey and Catherine.
Fascinating. You mentioned that TV spot. We want to play that and then just talk about it a little bit. So this is the spot that the FBI ran asking essentially for a tip to help them out. Let's listen.
This is an announcement by the FBI. Have you seen this woman? The FBI is offering $100,000 for tips leading to Catherine Grieg's whereabouts. These photos are from the early 1990s. Grieg has had plastic surgeries. She is wanted for harboring James Whitey Bulger, a fugitive on the FBI's 10 most wanted list.
So what do we know? Catherine Grieg, of course, Whitey Bulger's companion. What do we know if that really was the source of the tip?
Well, they're saying it is, that somebody actually saw not so much the spot that was designed for women's chat TV during the daytime, but it was rather on CNN covering the spot. They insist that is the case, and that's what got them there. It may well have gotten them there. And this was a good initiative. It's just that these were the initiatives that should have been taken 15 years ago and weren't. You gotta give these guys credit, this generation FBI credit. They got their man. But now that we find out that he was in Santa Monica for 15 years, it's stunning.
David, you've been doing a lot of reporting on this throughout the day today. What else did they recover? What, if anything, did they recover from that apartment?
I've just confirmed through one of my law enforcement sources in Southern California, they found $800,000 in the house.
Which explains how he'd been paying cash for 15 years, maybe.
Always paid in cash. He was, it's all fungible, and he had the cash, traveled with cash. He also had 26 guns in the house. It's rather intriguing, but again, people thought, yeah, he's going to have cash and he's going to have guns. I haven't found out yet whether he had the knife strapped to his ankle, as everybody always said he would. I don't know that. We'll find that out.
We're talking about the arrest of James Whitey Bulger late yesterday. If you have questions about this big crime story, you can give us a call at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We've got WBUR's David Boeri in the studio. And joining us as well is Dick Lair. He's a former reporter for the Boston Globe and now a professor of journalism at Boston University. He's also the co-author of Black Mass, The Irish Mob, The FBI, and A Devil's Deal, which tells a big part of this extraordinary Boston crime story. Dick Lair, welcome. It's good to have you.
Good to be with you.
So take us back a little bit and remind us how James Whitey Bulger and the FBI and Agent John Connolly essentially went into business together. You write that they cut a deal with the devil, essentially.
Yeah, it was back in the fall of 1975. Just even saying that year just shows you the legs, the longevity of this epic story. And that was a time when the FBI was encouraged to develop, as part of its informant program, underworld informants in its fight against the mafia. And John Connolly had the boyhood connections to one of the city's leading Irish gangsters, Whitey Bulger. And he cut that deal. And Whitey came on board, and he had the benefit of knowing already that his pal Stevie Flemmy had... there were gains to be made from palling up with the government. Steve Flemmy had a deal with the government and gotten some from Slack as a result of that. So why do you cut this deal? And the way it's supposed to work is information goes one way, meaning to the government and law enforcement, and that's hardly the case in this scandal. Almost from the beginning, the tables were turned, and Whitey became in charge. And he had, watching his back, a crew of FBI agents led by John Connolly and John Connolly's supervisor, John Morris.
So they really became his protector. And what kind of activities did they protect him? Did they allow him to get away with?
There's a lot of levels to the protection. We're talking about on-the-ground protection, where Connolly and others would leak the fact that other law enforcement agencies were trying to do Whitey Bulger and investigate him. There was the intelligence that there were other underworld people, figures, who were considering ratting against the Bulger gang. Some of those guys ended up dead. But there's also another level of the protection, and that was the way John Connolly spun the myth of Whitey Bulger to Boston through the media, through his relationships with reporters, and kind of helping sustain and create and promote this notion that Whitey's kind of a Robin Hood of South Boston, our good, bad guy. He's into the bookmaking and gambling and some of that stuff, but, you know, he protects his neighborhood, keeps it drug-free zone. That's a kind of protection that really helps out cold-blooded killer like Whitey Bulger.
So the information really didn't go two ways. In other words, did Whitey Bulger help the FBI in their fight against the Cosa Nostra?
I think the biggest, he gave some intelligence here and there. But again, going back to Connolly and his unbelievably remarkable skills of promoting Whitey Bulger, he used to claim, for example, that Whitey was crucial to taking down 98 Prince Street, getting the court authorization to put a bug in the Angiulo headquarters in the North End. Well, when reporters finally got a chance to really deconstruct that, Whitey was a late inning add-on. They already had what they needed from other confidential informants to get a bug inside 98 Prince Street. But for years, John Connolly would do the high five that without Whitey, we never would have gotten the mafia.
Fascinating.
What Dick and Jerry O'Neill did, which was terrific, was they went through and they saw the 302s, the FBI reports, the 209s, the FBI reports, and they often attributed to others. And the favorite line for their own murders, their own murders were disguised as under the intelligence that the murder was said to be committed by Cuban drug dealers or South American drug dealers. And what Larry O'Neill did that was brilliant was just to go through those reports, and they saw where Connolly was in fact downplaying their crimes, attributing them to others, and giving them credit for tips that really belonged to others.
Yeah, they papered over everything, and it looked terrific in terms of the internal paperwork at the FBI, but it was all public relations.
Well, we are talking about the arrest of James Whitey Bulger last night in Santa Monica, California. Give us a call with your questions about the case, about Whitey Bulger, about his legacy in Boston. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Waltham, and Andy's on the line. Welcome to Radio Boston, Andy.
Yeah, hi. My question is, if Whitey Bulger had 19 victims, the story here really is who allowed that to go on. And the families of those 19 victims are going to be there in court for sure. But I think whoever allowed John Connolly to do what he did, there's some other people who should be in jail besides John Connolly. That's my question. Why are there not more people that allowed John Connolly to do what he did?
Andy,
Walter in jail.
Andy, thank you so much for your call. David Boeri.
You know, I always thought that John Connolly could not have done what he's accused of doing alone. He had numerous people in the C3, which is the organized crime squad of the Boston office. He had numerous people he was working with. They were a solid core. He had many, many enablers. He's the only person, which is stunning here, he's the only person of that squad in this case that went to prison. And I've often thought that there is no justice as long as John Connolly is the only FBI agent, a retired agent who's in prison.
Yeah,
well,
no,
yeah, go ahead, Dick.
Well, I have to agree with David. There was promises of investigations, you know, once this blew open into the public, of really trying to tracing down the corruption through the halls of the FBI. But when at the end of the day, they just came back and it was John Connolly and his supervisor Morris, who never faced charges but had confessed and become a government witness.
Morris became the government witness.
So all these years later, though, we're really talking about a new generation of folks working for the FBI. Is there any reason to believe that things have changed, or what's your feeling about that?
I honestly feel that I'm sympathetic to them in many ways because as Judge Robert Barton once told me, there is a stain on that office of the Boston FBI that will be there for an entire generation. These people work in that bureau now. Never worked a case against Bulger. They never saw him. Many of them weren't alive when he was at his peak. It's a different crew. The problem is that even after the old guys retired, that search for Bulger wasn't run particularly efficiently, according to real fugitive hunters who looked at it from the outside.
WBUR's David Boeri, thanks so much. We're talking about the arrest of James Whitey Bulger. We want to hear your thoughts, your stories, if you're living in or from South Boston. What does this arrest mean to you, to Southie? What's Bulger's legacy in Boston? Give us a call, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK.
David, thank you very much. By the way, we'll be hearing a lot more of your reporting on All Things Considered, and I'm sure tomorrow as well. There are many chapters in this sordid story, and as we head into the break, here's a little bit more of the long history of the FBI's search for Whitey Bulger.
These gangland killings have a common thread. South Boston crime boss, Whitey Bulger, and his unlikely partner in crime.
The FBI has blood on its hands in connection with those murders.
Forget about the grand conspiracy theory that we got something to hide, because we don't. We absolutely don't have anything to hide.
I'm here to tell you, and have been for the last 2 years, we are out to catch him.
But we are absolutely committed to finding him and seeing that justice is served.
There's a 95% chance, the way I see it, that we are going to catch him.
Stay with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks.
We're talking about the arrest of Whitey Bulger, the FBI's most wanted man and Boston's most infamous criminal. He was arrested last night in California. He had disappeared in 1995, but for decades before that, Whitey Bulger and the Irish mob owned the streets of South Boston. Here's a little look back.
Competing street gangs run nickel and dime gaming and protection rackets. James Bulger is an enforcer and debt collector for one of them.
Even then, he's a legend in the neighborhood, the head of a local street corner gang. He's got this platinum blonde
hair. James Whitey Bulger became one of Boston's most notorious gangsters.
Shooters, Whitey Bulger's victims were dug up all around Boston, 19 in all. Some gang members
say, there's no question, for the better part of three decades, he terrorized this area.
What are your memories of Whitey Bulger? What does this arrest mean to you and to the city of Boston? Phone us in with, give us a call with your questions, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We're talking with journalist Richard Lair, author of Black Mass, which tells a lot of the story about Whitey Bulger. And Dick Lair, give us a sense of how Whitey Bulger was regarded in the streets of South Boston.
Well, I think the story has gone on for so long, you have to break that down into several acts.
Sure.
There was the first act, really, going back to the 60s and 70s and into the 80s, when he was seen as a kind of lovable Robin Hood type figure in Boston who helped old ladies cross the street and kept Southie free of drugs and whatnot. And as we talked about earlier, that was a myth that was developed and encouraged by his FBI agent handler, John Connolly. So that period it has some real length to it. And then you get into the late 1980s when journalists and the work we started doing at the Globe and then carrying on into the 90s began peeling away the onion on that story and on that myth. What the truth was an entirely different story. And it took a while for it to come out, but instead of the ultimate stand-up guy from South Boston who was loyal, who would never inform on anybody, he turned out to be the ultimate informant, an FBI snitch. Instead of protecting South Boston, he was betraying South Boston left and right. Hmm. He was part of, at the center of what is now known as the worst informant scandal in FBI history, because we're not talking about a single case or a single investigation that was compromised. We're talking about a way of life.
Right. And there was real brutality there, right? Oh. I mean, it was, and I'm wondering, I mean, just to sort of put this in perspective, tell us an anecdote about sort of the way he operated.
Well, he's closer to Hannibal Lecter than he is to Robin Hood. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just comes down to that. In terms of the information that has surfaced regarding some of the murders that went down.
Right.
And this is a pre-DNA era when they were pulling teeth and cutting fingers so there'd be almost impossible to identify the corpse if it was discovered. This is what made this guy tick. It doesn't get much uglier than that. And I think an anecdote that kind of captures the sense in the 80s that he owned this city has to do with Brian Halloran, again, a low-level gangster, criminal, who, for a variety of his own reasons, had actually gone to the authorities, gone to the government, ready to testify and inform about Whitey Bulger. Well, Whitey Bulger, not surprisingly, two things happen. First, Halloran is rejected from the witness protection program and thrown back out on the streets by this government that was so compromised. Instead of going after Bulger, they were spitting out people who had evidence against him. And then once he was on the street, Whitey Bulger just, in open daylight in South Boston, just, blew his brains out.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to add another voice to this conversation, if I may. He is Michael Patrick McDonald, author of what many consider to be one of the definitive memoirs of growing up in South Boston, the award-winning All Souls, a family story from Southie. He's also an author in residence at Northeastern University. Michael Patrick McDonald, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
I should say today you're joining us from the studios of KPCC in Los Angeles, of all places. Your family and Whitey Bulger intersect many times in history, and here you are in L.A. on the day that he's being arraigned in federal court this afternoon. So your first thoughts on the arrest and what it means for you and South Boston?
Well, I'm still in shock. I really can't believe it. I find it really hard to believe. I'm being in L.A., of course, on top of all of that, but I feel like it's a dream we're going to wake up from or something. But I'm really happy that maybe we can get to some of the deeper truths around the relationship between the Bulger organization and the feds beyond John Connolly. It would be nice to see some kind of, you hear a lot of stuff on the internet, a lot of rage and justifiably so, and a lot of call for vengeance and all that. But I want to, I mean, the guy's 81. I want to get some information from him. I think we all deserve that. We all deserve a kind of truth commission, especially those of us who grew up in South Boston's lower end, and lived through the culture of death that he cultivated. Right. The culture of silence and death that he cultivated, losing so many family members, neighbors, and just living with this rope around our necks that I think led to more recent decades, heroin epidemics, painkiller epidemics, OxyContin, and suicide epidemics in South Boston. I think that it's all connected.
That part of his legacy there. I mean, I'm sorry to interrupt you, Mr. McDonald, but I just want to remind folks that you grew up in the Old Colony Housing Project in South Boston. Take us into a little bit more detail of exactly what you're talking about that culture that Bulger created in South Boston. I mean, we heard Dick Lehrer talk about the things that were done in broad daylight that, convinced people maybe they shouldn't be talking.
Yeah, Southie's always been known to be a really insular, isolated world within a world. The projects were even more so. There were just so many layers to it, really. And, you grew up just knowing that there's things you don't talk about. I mean, when I first started writing All Souls in the late 90s, I didn't think anybody would read it. I think if I was aware of how many people would have read it, I might have been a little more careful, I would have been, more scared, actually. I mean, it was really scary when it came out, actually. And there were people on the bus reading it, and it was on the news, and I had to go underground a little bit. I mean, it's hard for us to you know, to remember a time not too long ago when it was really dangerous to talk about this stuff, because now it's just, you know, Southie's a different place in a lot of ways, and so many books have come out and so many things have been told, and that's a great thing. But there's so much more we need to learn. And now that we do have this openness, there's still a lot of people who are dealing with this legacy of trauma that you're not allowed to talk about.
Right.
People who have lost uncles, aunts, brothers, sisters to murder, to overdoses, disappearances, and so forth. Beyond the 19 that we talk about that are specific murders, I mean, there's this entire bloodbath that happened as a result of the culture that he created and cultivated.
Michael Patrick McDonald, you know, I've been watching a lot of video that people have been collecting throughout the day, you know, from residents in South Boston. And, you know, we've had our WBR reporters out there as well. There are still some people there who say, you know, maybe Whitey Bulger was a slightly benevolent gangster, that there were the occasional good things that he did for residents there. I mean, do people truly believe that? Is there any strain of truth in that perception?
Well, I'd guarantee that none of those people lost a family member to the multiple drug overdoses that happened throughout the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And or the murders or disappearances and so forth. I think a lot of people were able to believe some of that myth until it hit home. And then it would hit home, and you didn't believe it anymore, but you still weren't allowed to talk about it, which I think caused a lot of addiction and alcoholism. And of course, Southies had a really high suicide rate for a long time. And we heard about the suicides a lot in the late 90s, but it has held on to one of the highest suicide rates in the city for many, many years. I think all that's connected. It's about a culture, really. You know, that grew out of this really insidious alliance that Dick Lehr and Mr. O'Neill exposed.
Hey, Michael, this is Dick Lehr. How you doing?
Good. Good to see you.
Yeah, it's been a long time.
Strange. I wish you were here. I wish you could hang out.
I have to just share with the listeners that Michael couldn't be more accurate when his book came out, and it wasn't an easy thing to talk about, and he faced some real hostility and whatnot. And it was about the same time that we came out with Black Mass, and they kind of stood up as companion pieces in the sense that one was the journalistic account, but Michael's really brought the story home from the inside. And also, I think, revealed for the first time that despite this myth I was talking about, that Conley succeeded in planting in the media and sort of the public image of Whitey Bulger, Michael's story from the inside revealed, for at least to me for the first time, that on the ground, in the street, Michael, as a kid and kids he knew, they knew more about the truth, closer to the truth than the rest of the world did. And in his storytelling about, you know, Whitey was not a nice guy.
The Rotary Liquor Store at the Rotary Liquor Store at the end of Notorious Store at the end of Patterson Way, where I grew up. The big green shamrock on it. All the little kids, you know, when I was a teenager, my little brothers would, you know, they were like 8 and 9, and the name of that store was the Irish Mafia Store. you know, do you have 50 cents? I'm going to the Irish Mafia Store. I wrote a story about that in All Souls, and it's always been really ironic to me that you know, Billy Bulger would claim in front of a Senate hearing that he didn't know what his brother did for a living, because my 8-year-old brothers knew what his brother did for a living. He was in the Irish Mafia, you know. So we all knew, and usually when there was a murder or you know, anything went down, we all knew all the details around that too.
Michael Patrick McDonald and Dick Lehr, stand by. Let's take some calls. Bill is calling from South Boston. Hi, Bill.
How you doing?
Very well.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm actually really surprised by some of the comments I've been hearing about the capture of Whitey. One that sticks out in particular is a woman I saw a video clip of that said, Whitey was a mobster. That was his occupation. Everybody needs an occupation. What's the big deal? I can't wrap my head around that concept.
I saw that video too, Bill, and I think she said, you know, he never did anything to me, so just leave him alone, right?
I think that kind of...
Right. Yeah. So, I can't believe it. I can't wrap my head around that concept that people still think like that, knowing what everybody knows. I mean, there's no surprise he was a bad guy.
Yeah, I think that kind of thinking that you're referring to in some of those videos, that he's, you know, people have their head in the sand and whatnot. And I think that has to be confronted really head on, because the evidence, the weight of the evidence, is is so huge that this is not a person or deeds that he did or the impact he had on Boston or the Boston FBI to be taken lightly or brushed off. He did an enormous amount of damage to this city and to people in it. And that can't be kind of just like brushed aside.
Mm. And I think beyond Southie and the broader culture, I see that that's become a more and more popular stance. You know, with a lot of the television series and so forth, there's this embracing of the idea that gangsters are people too, you know, and they're just like us and they see therapists, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I like a lot of those shows and so forth, but I think that the danger is when where we see the larger culture kind of saying, well, you know, it's just a job and they're just people. They're like any one of us. Mm. And, you know,
frightening.
I mean, you know, he's a sociopath and a really, really dangerous person.
Let's take I'm sorry to interrupt you, Michael, but let's
no,
take,
go ahead. I just want to, you know, I don't think anyone can, unless you were there, realize the buckets of blood that came from this era.
Yeah. Let's take another call. Andy is calling from Acton. You're on the air, Andy.
Yes, thank you. I was interested, especially given the history of the folks on Beacon Hill and how many of them are in jail. What's the probability in all your research that Billy Bulger wasn't somehow aware of all that was going on and, in fact, may have helped Whitey along his career?
Andy, thank you so much for your call. Dick Lehrer?
Well, that's one of the big questions that's been asked over the years as well. And you can only go with what evidence has surfaced to sort of start to get at that in any way. And in our book, we have a chapter called 75 State Street, which is about a complicated real estate deal which involves Bill Bulger. But, you know, that's one of those things that, you know, big gaps that we could use a lot more answers and information about that if Whitey were to come back and start talking, we might know more. But I wouldn't bet on that.
Well, it's interesting. We've got a cut of tape of William Bulger talking just about this. This was in 2003. It was one of his rare public comments where he spoke publicly about his brother, and he was speaking in reaction to then Attorney General Tom Riley, who called for him to resign from the presidency of the University of Massachusetts. Here's what he said.
I have done everything one could possibly do to influence the course of another person's life. For Mr. Riley to somehow represent my efforts and the painful results as a wrong choice is irresponsible and is a gross distortion of the facts.
So that was William Bulger speaking in 2003. Dickler, I'm curious, and actually, same question to you, Michael Patrick McDonald. You talk about sort of a search for deeper truths. Now that Bulger is in custody, what are the remaining big questions that we might learn answers to? Dickler.
Well, journalistically, I would like to know more about where it went in the halls of the FBI, you know, all these many years. Again, the official criminal cases have ended with John Connolly and then the confessions of his supervisor, John Morris. A bunch of other agents have been touched up over the years, but a full accounting, which has never come, and I'm not sure it's going to happen now either. I mean, because what are the odds of Whitey Bulger doing a tell-all? I don't, you know.
Yeah, what would be in it for him?
Yes. Well, what are the odds of the FBI really wanting to let him do that, maybe?
Yeah, So, but that's the pieces that, you know, just remain untold, and I'm not sure we'll ever get at it as far as, you know, my interest as a journalist.
Yeah. You know, Michael Patrick McDonald, you'd mentioned the Rotary and how just everyone sort of knew what was going on there. And I think people who didn't grow up in the neighborhood really don't know in any level of detail just sort of the ways that Whitey Bulger's tentacles were everywhere. I mean, I was reading, Dick Lehrer, in your book that there's a scene where... a customer at the Rotary won the lottery, bought a ticket there and won the lottery, some $14 million. And Whitey Bulger decided that customer needed a partner and basically you know, took half the winnings and guaranteed himself $89,000 a year of income after taxes by extorting that, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, your winnings are not your own. And it's the same thing whether it's a legitimate lottery winnings like that or drug dealing. You know, drugs move through Southie, but you had to give a piece to Whitey.
And Anthony, I think you've done some reporting from down there that just got that story and that more detail like that.
Well, it's true. And Mike, some of the comments that Michael Patrick McDonald made me think of this. A couple of years back, I interviewed Richard Marinick. He's a former state cop who crossed the line and became a Bulger enforcer. He ended up going to jail for 10 years for armed robbery. And when he came out, he wrote a couple of books about this, including one called Boyos. And I went to South Boston with him back in 2008, and he provided some pretty interesting insights about what it was like to work with Bulger back in the day. And here's just a little bit of that interview. The Irish mob no longer owns these streets, but there are plenty of landmarks from the old days. Marinick points out where Triple O's used to be, the restaurant that was headquarters for the notorious mob boss James Whitey Bulger.
He had an office right above the place. He had what you might call a torturous chamber down in the basement. He used to bring people down there, kill them, take them out the back door. There's at least a couple people they took out of there.
Bulger is also known for this. His brother is the former state Senate president, William Bulger, for years a major force in state politics.
He was a loved political over here. People loved him, came out in droves to vote for him. If Jimmy was his brother, Whitey was his brother, how could Whitey be really that bad? And if he was bad, well, he was probably more like a Robin Hood-type character. That was the legend that followed Jimmy Bulger around in South Boston. But since he went on the run, a lot of information has come out. He was a drug dealer. He was a murderer. But you get the hardcore cadre that still supports both brothers, saying, no, it couldn't have been that way.
You know, I did some interviews on the street here when he disappeared, and I found some elderly people who didn't strike me as gangsters, but they said things like, when he was around, this neighborhood was safe. Fact. I mean, there was sort of this idea that he looked out for his own and he made this place safe.
I agree with that. I mean, in those days, the neighborhood was safe. You had the Irish mob element. You had the gangsters roaming around here, but you didn't have junkies breaking into houses. You did not have people getting mugged in the street, period. It didn't happen. If Mrs. O'Malley... It's got a group of kids, teenagers, loud and boisterous on her corner, keeping her up at night. Everybody in Southie knew someone in those days. She'd make a phone call. It would eventually get back to Jimmy Bulger or one of his lieutenants, and they'd send someone like myself down there. My friends would go down to the corner. You get one warning.
So you had your own crew here.
Yeah.
You had interaction with Jimmy Bulger,
right,
with Whitey Bulger. What was he like? I mean,
Jimmy Bulger was a steely-eyed businessman, number one. And a cold-blooded murderer, number two.
And that came across when you looked at him?
There was no doubt. He had these eyes that told you, and he had this persona. People will hit you with the aura. This guy pounded you with his aura. You had no doubt when you were dealing with Jimmy Bulger that he would, in fact, kill you if you crossed him. And it happened to me once. I can't go into what I wanted to do, and he told me straight up I'd end up in the trunk of his car.
That's author Richard Marinick talking to me in South Boston back in 2008 about James Whitey Bulger. He used to work for Bulger, served time for robbery. He's the author of two books, Boyos and In for a Pound. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. I'm going to say goodbye to Dick Lehr. Thanks so much for coming in, Dick. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Dick Lehr, professor of journalism at BU and author of Black Mass, The Irish Mob, the FBI, and A Devil's Deal.
Stay with us. There's much more after the break. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking about the arrest of Whitey Bulger. We're joined today by Michael Patrick McDonald. He is author of the national bestseller, All Souls, A Family Story from Southie. He joins us today from Los Angeles, where 16 years after Bulger disappeared, federal agents found him yesterday in a Santa Monica apartment building. He's being arraigned in L.A. this afternoon. U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz says Bulger could be extradited back to Boston in 48 hours.
So Bulger may be coming back to Boston, but yesterday's capture followed years of countless Bulger sightings and reports, some more credible than others. Radio Boston's Adam Ragusea reminds us of a few of those.
Cops and reporters have been playing the Where's Whitey game since 1995.
Bulger's been on the run ever since. An unconfirmed report today said he'd spent time in the Caribbean.
Even the feds are left wondering where to send their birthday cards.
Maybe he's living, you know, in a remote location in France or Spain or Ireland.
In the last few days, a tantalizing rumor swept through Boston law enforcement. The rumor, Whitey Bulger is dead, that he died of a heart attack in Costa Rica.
Yeah, that one turned out to be less than solid. But of all the leads throughout the years, three particularly cinematic ones stand out. One story goes like this. In 1994, before Whitey went on the lam, a London businessman gets chatty with Bulger in the gym at Le Meridian Piccadilly Hotel. 9 years later, the same businessman spots Bulger on the street in Piccadilly Circus and says, "Hi, mate, how you doing?" "No, no, no, you've got the wrong guy," Bulger mutters. The businessman thinks nothing of it until a week later he goes to the movies and sees Hannibal.
"I must confess to you, I'm giving very serious thought to eating your wife."
A movie about fake serial killers that, in one shot, also happens to show mugs of real serial killers, one of whom looks quite familiar to our businessman. The FBI and Scotland Yard subsequently find two safety deposit boxes linked to Bulger, one in London, the other in Dublin.
"I don't want to be a product of my environment. I want my environment to be a product of me."
In 2006, Whitey found his way into another movie as the basis of Jack Nicholson's character in Martin Scorsese's The Departed. Authorities went on to investigate a possible Whitey sighting at a screening of the movie in San Diego, though more than a few observers wondered if it might have been a Hollywood publicity stunt. The following year, the feds thought they might have fingered Bulger as the star of a rickety cell phone video, thus ruining the Italian vacations of thin, gray-haired white men everywhere.
Police videotape provides some of the few images of Bulger. He was tracked to the Sicilian resort town of Taormina. Police believe these images show Bulger with his long-term girlfriend, Catherine Gregg.
Italian police hauled Robert Dowdy of Warwick, Rhode Island in for questioning. In Perugia, Italy, at 9 in the morning, coming out of mass, there was only one gray-haired Irish guy, Dowdy told WBZ at the time. "Nobody would have looked at me in downtown Boston. Would Whitey Bulger wear a Yankee hat?" The video later made its way to the German equivalent of America's Most Wanted, at which point an elderly German couple called authorities to thank them for providing such lovely footage of their holiday.
So, Adam, that last lead in Sicily was clearly discredited. What about the lead in a movie theater in Southern California?
Not a confirmed sighting, according to the FBI. They reiterated at their press conference earlier today, actually, that the last confirmed sighting was in 2003 in London, when that London businessman saw Whitey's face in a movie. But, you know, the fact that he was nabbed yesterday in Southern California certainly seems like an interesting coincidence. But, you know, more seriously, I think this all invites the question that David Boeri alluded to earlier. How did Bulger get from Europe back to the United States after 2003 amid all the post-9/11 security precautions?
One of many questions which now people are facing. Radio Boston's Adam Ragusa, thank you so much.
Sure thing.
And to answer a few more questions, joining us now to talk about some of the legal issues surrounding the arrest of Whitey Bulger is Michael Sullivan. He's the former U.S. Attorney for the District of Massachusetts from 2001 to 2009. Mr. Sullivan is now a partner at the Ashcroft Group. And Mr. Sullivan, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome, Anthony. Good to be with you.
Good to have you. Now, as we look forward to a possible trial, what's going through the minds of federal prosecutors right now?
Well, first off, I'm sure relief, and then excitement, and then now gearing up for what would be considered trial prep. Fortunately, it's a tremendous team of trial attorneys led by Fred Wyshak and Brian Kelly. These folks know the facts of the Bulger case inside and out. They've been eating, sleeping, and dreaming about this day for a long period of time, so I am confident they'll be absolutely prepared to try this case as soon as the judge and or the defendant say that they're ready for trial.
So a trial, obviously, but also an opportunity to answer some questions. I know this would be pure speculation at this point, but are there any types of deals that you could imagine that the prosecution could make with Bulger in order to get crucial information out of him about past crimes?
I would be shocked if they made a deal with Bulger that benefited Bulger as it relates to the sentence that he's faced with in the District of Massachusetts, which is a life sentence. Now, having said that, I would not be shocked or surprised if there was an opportunity for Bulger's cooperation to be credited toward somebody else, in particular his female supporter, Catherine Greig.
I see. So in terms of sort of answering some of the big mysteries about crimes that were committed in the past, I mean, is that likely to come out of a Whitey Bulger trial?
I suspect that's probably less of an interest at this point in time, unless some of those crimes remain within the statute of limitations. I think what would be very interest, what the government would be very interested in learning about is how was Bulger able to stay as a fugitive for the last 16 years, who may have assisted him during that period of time, and whether or not their assistance could result in charges. And beyond that, the people that have been cooperating with the government and have provided information to the government, whether the information that they've provided over these years has been factual and truthful. So I think that's where the government would be focusing. The government has a very good understanding of the crimes that Bulger has been implicated and charged in, and obviously they've developed the evidence, sufficient evidence, you know, to charge him for 19 of the murders.
Well, those questions that you posed are some big and interesting questions that we'll look forward to hearing about. Michael Sullivan, former U.S. Attorney for the District of Massachusetts and partner at the Ashcroft Group, thanks so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Michael Patrick McDonald, let me turn back to you for a last thought. You are in Los Angeles today, and if I understand correctly, you have plans to go to the arraignment of Whitey Bulger in the next hour or two. I guess that's the very next step in this story. And my question for you is, when you sit there in the arraignment and they bring him in, what do you think might be going through your mind being in the same room with him after all these years?
I have no idea, but I will be leaving here in about 5 minutes and heading downtown to the federal courthouse. I don't know what that will feel like, but I feel like what's happening in the coming days and weeks is with a lot of the media frenzy is that it might be focused on this individual personality, or maybe, you know, one or two personalities in law enforcement and so forth. But getting back to the question about deeper truths and just the idea of, you know, why would we want to explore more deeply this relationship between law enforcement and some, you know, one of the worst sociopaths in the history of Boston? It's not, you know, a lot of people are dead and gone and they're not coming back. But we want to explore this more deeply so that I believe so that we can prevent this from happening in other communities throughout the city. This isn't so. To me, it's not just about Whitey Bulger. It's not just about Southie. It's not just about a particular era. It's about a place down the street, wherever you are in this country. This kind of thing could happen again in a community if we're not careful. So I think it's important for that reason, for the sake of kids growing up in, whether it's in, you know, Compton out here in L.A. or back home in neighborhoods in Boston or in East New York, Brooklyn, wherever. You know, people are dealing with the same issues all the time with law enforcement relationship with some of the worst people we could possibly come across.
Well, Michael,
I'd like to explore it for that reason.
And it's worth absolutely exploring for that and many other reasons. Michael Patrick McDonald, can't thank you enough for making the time to be with us today. He's the author of All Souls, A Family Story from Southie. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Radio Boston is a production of WBUR with regular contributions from The Angle at Boston.com.
Send us your comments on the Whitey Bulger story at RadioBoston.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.